It broadcasts. Well, hey everyone. Welcome to Mindshare March 4. I'm here with Ellen. Hey, Ellen.
Hi, Anne. Hi, everybody.
So let's talk about what we're excited about. First of all, both Ellen and I were at the NTA conference, as a lot of you were. I know it was so fun to run into people and say hi, and I'm pretty excited about it. Margaret and I presented, and you know, while we teach together a lot, it's the first time we ever did like a formal presentation together. And it went really, really well. And we received a lot of really good feedback on it. I thought the conference was good, although, the way it was laid out in the hotel, right, Ellen, it just didn't seem to flow very well from that perspective. Tierra Low Dog was fabulous, and as well as a number of other speakers. So, I'm excited about that. And we have a level one starting today. Ellen, how about you?
That's right. Yeah, I guess I'm excited about that too. Here we go. Next round
here
of
we go.
Level ones. I know, which is going to be pretty great. Yeah. I'm excited about all that. I'm excited to be home. Weekends away like that are always a little bit hard. I'm excited to be back to eating my own home cooked food, I would say. But yeah, that's fine.
We won't talk about the visits to Petunias.
No. We'll just gloss right over that.
Yeah. I am like literally exhausted, as well as excited to be with you all tonight. So, as we do, we're going to answer questions from the forum, and time allowing, we'll have hopefully some time at the end to answer some live questions. And just a reminder, if you could use the Q&A to ask questions, not the chat function, it just kind of helps us keep track of things a little easier. So first question is from Joey, and she says, I have two new clients who do not have their gallbladder. They are both doing some initial healing work and plan to do a GI map and an MRT. I'm curious what kind of nutrition support I should be considering in addition to bile salts. I've been imagining additional liver support could be indicated, and I'm wondering if bile viscosity support with beta TCP is still helpful at this point or not. Would love more information on how to support and what to be looking for. So really good question, Joey. And we typically think of that bile salt formula like beta plus instead of something like beta TCP for people who no longer have their gallbladder. It basically has the same ingredients as beta TCP. It has the organic beet concentrate and the pancreolipase, just with the addition of the ox bile extract. You know, liver support is never a bad idea, honestly. It doesn't matter what a person is dealing with or if they don't have anything. I think liver support's always a good idea. Is the client eating an organic, clean diet? Are they exposed to high levels of exogenous toxins? Aren't we all? Do they drink large amounts of alcohol? How many other supplements are they taking? You know, so I think about it in two ways. I think about it, you know, do they have the bandwidth to take one more thing targeting the liver? And also, are they taking a boatload of supplements that could be potentially creating, you know, a hardship on the liver, having to, you know, break down and conjugate all those supplements as well. So those are all the factors that I think about to discuss with your client and to consider.
All right, great. Our next question was from Jolene. And she says, I'm running into clients who aren't able to afford to retest using the GI map. My question is there a standard time a person should stay on a supplement like calcium D-glucarate for their high beta-glucuronidase when they cannot afford to retest, or would just rather not? Also, same idea with someone on supplements for their hormones. I know we should retest every 4 months, but if you retest and things look okay, does that mean they can stop using the supplements, or does that mean the supplements are working so you should keep them? Supplements such as Equal, Feminescence Pro, and Optocrine. When will your body begin to maintain making its own hormones? And or do you use these supplements long term? I'm a little confused about this. So obviously, Jolene, you know, the best thing is always going to be to get people to retest so that we're not in any sort of a guessing situation. But there also, in reality, are always going to be people who can't or who just won't. And I think that's a reality. with something like calcium deglucarate, you know, assuming that you've identified and addressed the root cause of why that beta-glucuronidase was elevated in the first place, which is almost always from the presence of dysbiotic bacteria, there shouldn't be any sort of long-term support to continue a supplement like calcium deglucarate. Now, you're only really going to 100% know if you took care of the dysbiosis by retesting, but, you know, sometimes perhaps you can tell by symptom resolution as well. With something like hormones, you know, when things are looking good on retest and people are continuing to feel really good, you could probably start to space retesting out a little bit, you know, but we'd always recommend that you test at least twice a year, every 6 months, because you want to make sure that things are holding and don't need adjusting and levels aren't building up and getting out of whack and things like that. You know, as for needing to continue the supplements long term, it's just so individual. Many times once you've addressed root causes like gut, you know, they just won't need them anymore. But you might not know that unless you retest and you see the higher levels on there telling you that you can dial it back a little bit. You know, and it's also very individual as to whether somebody can actually start to make hormones themselves again. It probably all depends on why they stopped having adequate hormones in the first place. You know, a 75-year-old man, for example, is probably not going to start just making robust amounts of testosterone on his own, even once you've addressed all the issues that led into the decline. So, you know, that's always going to be a very individual situation as to what the body can or can't do.
And I would just add to that and just say, you know, there's a whole school of thought these days that, you know, just as Ellen was saying, a 75-year-old man is going to make it. These are 55-year-old women, 55 and above. And we know that estrogen is really important for heart health and bone health and cardiovascular health. So, you know, there's a good case to be made for continuing those hormones. And if somebody, that's just the conversation anyway to have with your clients. Some people in the absence of symptoms just don't want to take anything. While others, you know, want to take it proactively. And if they choose to do that, you would definitely want to insist on retesting. Jolene also had a question on, can you tell me how to order the RWS Complete Blood Panel? Is it still available through Direct Labs? And if so, how do I find it there? So Jolene, we now consider Avexia our preferred provider for blood chemistries. You can still order a version of the RWS panel through Direct Labs. It's, I don't even remember where it is, Ellen, do you? It's been so long since I ordered one.
I don't know where to find it. I'd have to poke around in there. Yeah.
Yeah. I can find out, Jolene, if you want to, contact me individually, like you're not willing to do Avexia at all, I will find out for you. But Avexia is so much less expensive. You know, it's really our preferred provider for blood chemistries and for the GI map. So there's a lot of reasons to go there. Now there is an annual $50 fee, but it's well worth signing up for it because you're going to make that up in the cost of the blood panels, you know, unless you just want to do one and that's all you're ever going to do, contact me and I'll let you know how to do that with Direct Labs. The other thing I thought I would just take an opportunity to announce is that Avexia is now offering the option to use either Quest or LabCorp. And they're opening up the ability for practitioners to use LabCorp kind of in waves. And if that's something that you really want to do to be able to offer your clients, like in some locations across the country, there's LabCorps where there aren't Quests, especially in more rural areas. You know, they're just random. Sometimes it's Quest, sometimes a LabCorp. If LabCorp would be more convenient for you in some cases, give Carolyn at Avexia a call and she'll kind of prioritize you to set that up.
That's pretty great. Okay, so now we have some questions from Joey that have to do with the GI map. If someone is 100% gluten-free, should the anti-gliadin IgA be zero? If it's not, but within the normal range, in this case 75, when anything below 157 is considered normal, are we thinking there is gluten exposure or immune activity in regards to it? Joey, we almost never see this number come back at zero. We consider anything in the normal range to mean, you know, that there's no exposure or no immune reaction going on to it. Just remember that this marker can, in fact, elevate if there's the presence of something that the body is cross-reacting to that it looks at and thinks is gluten, even though it isn't. And that's dairy and lots of other grains and sesame and a few other interesting things as well. And there's no good, easy, cheap way to find out what those might be, but just be aware that that could be an option.
You know, one of the things I'm really suspicious about is cassava. I have a lot of clients who are 100% gluten-free. They don't hardly eat any grains at all. But cassava is one because it's so yummy and it's so gluten-like. And they keep coming back high. So I have a couple of them that I'm experimenting with now. They've come back high a couple times and now they're taking out all the cassava. And I'm going to, you know, upon retest, see if it's finally gone.
Interesting. Very interesting. So the next part of Joey's question was, when beta-glucuronidase is within normal limits but starting to get up there, at what point or when should we consider supporting this? I have a client who's very sensitive and her level is 1705, with normal being anything under 2486. I'm wondering if this is significant or not. Where do you consider the point at which, while considered normal, it may still need support? So generally, Joey, we would rarely decide to support with something like calcium deglucurate when the number was still in range, unless you were really seeing some very strong signs of estrogen dominant symptoms in your client and you were doing it just sort of like, you know, Band-Aid type of support to get her through. Once again, you address why it's elevated and what's made that go up, which is usually dysbiosis, that should resolve very quickly. The next part, what do you make for someone who has no gallbladder, yet the steatocrit is below detectable limits? Is this because they're watching their fat intake and didn't do the challenge? Even so, I would have thought this marker would have come back elevated. You know, it's hard to say exactly. It certainly could be because they were avoiding dietary fat, you know, if they didn't eat enough fat.
A lot with people.
Yeah, you know, if they don't have a gallbladder, they've just gotten really used to not eating fat, right? It also could just mean that their pancreatic lipase output is really robust and it's helping them handle fats pretty adequately. No matter what, somebody who doesn't have a gallbladder, we'd always still recommend something like Beta Plus with meals and then a diet that does have lots of good healthy fat in it, because then they would be able to digest it. And the last part here is, I have a test from a woman with MS where not much was out of range, but quite a few things are starting to register. 6 opportunistic bacteria are registering, but within normal. No worms, yeast, or protozoa. H. pylori is registering, but low, and no virulence factors. She came to see me for upper GI issues and has had huge improvements with diet, healing supplements, and HCL. However, she has several low normal flora, high steatocrit, high SIGA, and a calprotectin at 104. I'm just wondering if this is a situation where addressing some of those opportunistic bacteria may be prudent, along with robust digestive supports and Megaspore. Or do I just support the microbiome and digestion and not do an eradication protocol? I realize you don't have more details on my client. My big picture is this the kind of presentation where you might address the findings, even though these are within normal range? You know, certainly there are situations where we would look at the big picture, taking into account how many of these bacteria are showing up, even though they're not yet lab high, putting that all into the picture with what's going on with the client clinically, and making some decisions. You know, we don't know when these things show up as present but not yet lab high. Are they on their way up? You know, are they continuing to grow and thrive and get out of control? Which in her case, they certainly might be doing, given that she has low normal flora, which would allow them to take hold and really populate things. You know, for someone like this, with the very little that we know here, where her SIGA and her calprotectin are out of line, she has an active autoimmune condition, MS. You know, you'd want to be getting her gut as healthy as you possibly could. So something like perhaps a biocidin eradication protocol. And of course, don't forget NMRT and elimination. That could be a really good path. Those food sensitivities, just absolutely critical with an autoimmune process. And you'd also want to definitely be supporting her microbiome and probably be thinking about some types of immune supports as well, since she does have MS, unfortunately.
Okay, this question is from Ellen regarding Campylobacter. So she says, I have a 17-year-old client that tested positive for Campylobacter on the GI map. This is not a surprise, as he and his friends have a habit of collecting fresh roadkill, skinning and cooking it. I'm not supposed to know this, but my daughter goes to school with him. My understanding is that, sorry guys, let's turn this off. Are you seeing that, Ellen?
No, what you, I don't.
Okay. What, all right, good. Somebody's texting me. It's coming across the screen. Glad you're not seeing me. Okay. No. My understanding is that this is a referral if it in an acute phase. Excuse me. He does not have the acute symptoms of vomiting and fever, but he has had general malaise and loose stools for about a year. They sent him to medical care and they just labeled him with IBS. It's very common. So other findings on his GI map are some low normal bacteria, low Firmicutes. Under dysbiotic bacteria, he's high for Morganella. And he has five species that are detectable but not out of range. Bacillus, Enterococcus facialis, Staphylococcus, Klebsiella pneumoniae, and Candida. Diatomeeba fragilis was also detected, but not out of range. Excuse me. And his SIGA was elevated at 5731, and he had high antigliadin. They had been gluten-free, but decided to challenge it for the test. They do a fair amount of international travel. And so her questions are, she was not planning to refer him out for the Campylobacter since he's not acute. But they, you know, she's going to tell them to keep the doctor informed. But her focus is to work on the microbiome. Do you agree with that strategy or should I still refer out? And then can biocidin knock this back to undetectable levels? So if he's not acute, there really is no reason to refer out. It's always a good idea to advise all clients to share their results with their doctor and to make a notation in their record that you've done that. But many of these pathogens, you know, you can use high-dose probiotics and natural antimicrobials, and that's really the answer. And so by high dose, I mean using something like Megaspore and another strain-specific formula together, something like, I would use something like the Prio ProBioMed 50 by Designs for Health, and I would use those two together. And then her next part is, I'm thinking biocidin can be used to address everything else. I will also be putting him on adaptogenic support for stress and low energy, HCL, enzymes, GI Revive, GI Detox, and Megaspore. Am I missing anything? MRT, first and foremost. I would also add in addition to the biocidin and GI Detox, I'd add in the Oliverics, because that's a really powerful combination. You know, we're on our, as we always do when we start a new level one class, we go through the healing solutions. And the biocidin, Oliverics, GI detox is another alternative. It's another triad alternative to the AP Meg GI Microbex Interface Plus for protozoa and for bacteria. So it's a really good combination. So I would add that in. And then you mentioned enzymes, but you didn't mention earlier if the elastase 1 was depressed, or you're just doing that. I don't know why you're doing that, because you didn't say that that was depressed. Otherwise, the protocols looks good with the addition of that second probiotic. So Ellen goes on to say that she was not going to do a parasite protocol specifically, since it was only detected and out of range. She said, if things do not get better midway or three quarters of the way through the protocol, we could reconsider this. Do you agree? I said, yes. And I think the biocidin and the Oliverics will deal with all of it. You know, just those low brewing protozoa. I've seen the biocidin, Oliverics, and GI detox wipe out, you know, elevated strains of those protozoa. So I think you'll be real successful with that. He has a lot of food sensitivity, so it ends up she did do, I'm thinking, an MRT. She didn't say for sure. He's already gluten-free, dairy-free, tested positive for chicken egg yolks, and he does feel good eating eggs for breakfast, which is a quick and easy thing for him. I was wondering if he could try duck eggs instead and see how that feels, since MRT only tests chicken eggs. She did do an MRT. So here's my thinking on that. you can bring in duck eggs instead of chicken eggs, but I'd wait until you get some resolution with the symptoms, because if you add in the duck eggs right away and he's reacted to them, you won't know why he's not making progress. So I'd wait until his symptoms calm down and his stools firm up. And that way you'll be able to tell if the duck eggs are well tolerated or not.
Ellen asked if you could just repeat what those, the probiotic combination that you suggested, Anne?
Sure, it's called ProBioMed 50, and it's a really high dose four strain formula from Designs for Health, ProBioMed 50. Ellen also says, on a different client, she has a 60-something-year-old female client who has Hashimoto's and chronic fatigue for most of her adult life. She's been doing a keto diet. Her GI map showed detectable but not out-of-range bacteria, poor fat digestion, a need for enzymes, and low secretory immunoglobulin A. We're using biocidin at half the full dose to address the weeds in her garden. We're using the drops so that we could titrate up slowly. She's doing 5 to 7 drops twice a day. Beyond that dose, she gets a rash on her face that burns. It's hard to know if it's just a detox reaction or if it's a reaction to the biocidin. She's able to tolerate that lower dose. So they're sticking to that in addition to lots of functional support, adrenal support, Sarah Foster sleep, and my community mushrooms to help with the low SIGA. So her question is, you know, have we ever had this type of reaction with biocidin? They're staying at the low dose, but if it keeps happening, I'm thinking of changing to another antimicrobial to rebalance the microbiome and deal with the dysbiosis. No, actually, we have never seen that with the biocidin, but you know, we've only been using that for maybe 9 months or so. So it could be a sensitivity to an ingredient in the formula. And you know, at a certain threshold, she becomes reactive to whatever that ingredient is. Or it could be a healing reaction. So I suggest that you keep her at the tolerated 8 drops. Like I'd keep her at the highest dose, 8 drops. She said 5 to 8. I'd keep her at 8 drops twice a day for 2 weeks and then try again to titrate it up higher. If she still reacts with a rash, it's likely a sensitivity. And you can then either consider switching her to a different formula or extending her protocol another month. So 8 drops is only 2 drops less, but you're doing it twice a day rather than 3 times a day. So you could either, you know, keep her at those 8 drops since we love the biocidin. It's clearly such a great agent, or add in another agent, you know, that could potentially add to the benefits of the biocidin, you know, and she wouldn't be reactive to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think while we haven't necessarily seen rash, you know, I've at least seen some people who you have to go pretty slow with biocidin when they're real toxic and backed up. That
yeah, I've seen other symptoms, but not rash specifically. So,
okay. So Natalie asks, I have a 35-year-old client who presents with extreme vulvar itching of unknown cause. History of this for over 10 years. She has chronic extreme itching elsewhere on her body also. It moves around, but it's most extreme in the vulva and urethra. There's no eczema or skin disorder with it, just the itching. She's been to dozens of doctors all over the country for years, had tons of testing, even a biopsy of the area, nothing found. She had a reduction in symptoms since going on AIP a year and a half ago. However, the symptoms are still very bothersome and interfere with life. Her GI map came back very benign, only one elevated bacteria. And it was only slightly above normal. Candida detected, but it was low, not flagged as high. Everything else was below detectable limits. It was a surprise that her GI was this unremarkable. Her MRT had no reds and about 20 yellows. We'll start a GI healing protocol the next time we meet, but I know there's something besides her gut that's going on here. She's also had loads of blood work over the years with nothing uncovered. Would you be thinking mold or heavy metals? She says she's been tested for metals, but not mold. After over a decade of this, she has no diagnosis. This poor woman, I really feel for her. And I know how much upset you must have been when her GI map did not come back with all of these, you know, raging things on there. But I think, you know, the fact that AIP helped her in some way is a big clue that this is inflammatory in nature. And you need to be doing everything that you possibly can to reduce that immune burden, basically. So doing the MRT elimination and the gut healing is huge, and dealing with that streptococcus, it's, you know, just the only thing that showed up high, but we definitely want to deal with it. I would ask, you know, does she have any other signs that would lead you to suspect that maybe there's more candida in her system? It's so hard to pick it up on any stool test. That its presence on the GI map and the type of symptoms that she's having, which certainly could be created by a systemic yeast, you know, might lead me to do an antifungal protocol along with the rest of the work on her gut. Having said that, if you're using something like biocidin, you know, that's going to help if there's yeast going on. If you work with the oat test, the organic acids test, of course, that could clue you in if she's got more systemic yeast issues that aren't in her gut. Definitely because of the inflammation, you will be supporting her immune system. So if you're going to do gut healing with her anyway, maybe something like Mega Mucosa, which is going to do the gut healing and the immune support, or you could use the Mega IgG 2000 capsules for the immune support, glutathione, turmeric, those types of things. I just wanted to say, I know this shows up other places in her body, but simply for symptom relief, there could be some benefit in trying to address maybe some vaginal pH issues as well, which can certainly allow for bacteria to get out of balance. Some things that I have done some research into and heard great things about, but do not have any experience using. There is a gel. It's called IsoFresh, I-S-O Fresh, and it's a balancing gel specifically for vaginal pH, and a provider that I really respect, I heard recommending that. There's also some probiotics that actually can be used intravaginally. There's even a swab test for the vaginal microbiome. It's called the One Swab, and it's a DNA-based test. So it's a PCR test, just like the GI map, that specifically looks at the beneficial lactobacillus in the vagina and the balance of aerobic and anaerobic bacteria. And I understand that if she can get her doctor to order it, it's usually covered by most insurance. Again, just something I've heard good things about, but no personal experience with. I just want to come back to your question about mold. Is it possible? Sure. I mean, weird systemic things like that that you're just not able to try to figure out. I think you do start to think about environmental exposures at that point, and mold would be potentially a really big one. But as we talked in person this weekend, mold is a Pandora's box, and be careful what you wish for when you start looking for it. I would make sure that you've gone through all these obvious things with her first. And then, you know, you could consider as a first step something like a mycotoxin panel, just to see if that even sets off any alarm bells, and where do you want to go from there?
Yeah, and I think the fact that that she felt better on AIP is a big indication that foods are related, you know. And so I would be curious to know how long she's been off her MRT foods and if that provided any relief at all. Okay. Kate has a question about alternative supplements or protocols. There are a lot of things in the healing solution supplements that she can't get in the Canada without paying overinflated prices and waiting 2 weeks for delivery. For the triad, she can get GI Microbex and Intenzyme 14, but not the AP Mag. So Kate, you know, as I was saying earlier, we have a second triad for protozoa eradication. It's the biocidin, Olivarix, and GI detox. Are you able, I think you're on the call, are you able to get those formulas? If so, that's what I'd recommend. If not, instead of the AP Mag, you could use something like pyrostenol from Apex. Without knowing what you can get easily, it's hard to know if that's helpful or not. She's also unable to get critical digestion. What's her next choice? As an alternative to critical digestion, I would recommend the Bio 6 Plus from Biotics. Now it's a lower dose. It's a little wimpier than critical digestion, so you may need to up the dose. I'd recommend like 2 per meal if the elastase one is like, say, less than 300.
Kate did comment, she's on here, she can't get biocidin either. So, it might be most helpful, Kate, for us to talk with you offline about what you can get and help you do some brainstorming.
Yeah, we're happy to do that with you. Yeah. She also is not able to get Megaspore. So, Enviromedica has a new one called Terraflora, and then you know, you could, what I would suggest is that you try to get some sort of soil-based or spore-based form. And Ellen also comments that there is, well, if you can't get the biocidin, you can't get that either.
So. No. Yeah, the people who make biocidin also make a nice spore-based probiotic, but yeah. So why don't you connect with one of us offline and we'll do some brainstorming with you.
Yeah, what I would do is I would find a couple strain-specific formulas that are different and rotate those. You know, so like the ProBioMed 50 or the ProBioMax DEF from Zymogen, if you're able to get those are two good ones.
Okay. We have a question from, I don't know if it's Shia or Chaya, so please forgive me. Shia?
Yep. I think it's okay. Chaya.
Chaya? Okay. Well, welcome. Sorry for not pronouncing your name right. She asks, I was looking at the GI Healing Solutions page, and I noticed a discrepancy of dosing between the GI Revive capsules versus the GI Revive powder. On the Healing Solutions, the recommended dose for capsules is 3 caps twice a day. That would total just under 1.5 grams of L-glutamine for the day. The GI Revive powder is dosed at 1 tablespoon 2 times a day, equaling 3 grams of L-glutamine per day. In order to get that much L-glutamine in capsules, it would be 7 capsules twice a day, not 3. Is there a reason for this difference? Is there a typo? Is there a certain amount of L-glutamine that you typically recommend to support therapeutic gut healing? You're right, and it's a good catch. The reason mostly being on our newest version of the Healing Solutions, you're going to see we're actually reducing that powder dose down to 1 teaspoon twice a day. It's a very expensive supplement, and we have found that we get good results by not dosing it at a full tablespoon. I think the thing to remember when you're talking about the GI Revive products, though, is that these are combination products, so they have a lot more other amazing gut healing things in them beyond just L-glutamine, lots of different herbs and things like that. So when we have to use straight glutamine powder, like with people who have MRT sensitivities and we can't use these products, we do go for a higher dose because it's just straight L-glutamine. And that's why we like the Vital Nutrients powder in particular, because it's one of the highest available doses per teaspoon. So really with GI Revive, it's kind of the synergy of all of the things that are in there.
Chaya also has a question on parasites on the GI map. Since the parasites on the GI map can show up but not be considered pathogenic, I understand eradicating them if they are symptomatic. If they're not, if they are less than detectable limits and not symptomatic, do we not address them? Is that correct? I have a hard time wrapping my head around not wanting to eradicate them. It is literally just a quantity thing. Those parasites are still alive in there, right? If their immune system drops or they're under stress, wouldn't it allow them to overgrow into pathogenic range? Or could the biofilm just be hiding them enough for them to not show up in pathogenic range? Seems worth getting them out. Most clients I have seen like this so far have other imbalances, so it would just seem easier to just address it up front. Just curious to hear more thoughts on this. I'm just starting to get into running lots of GI maps. Maybe since the GI map is more sensitive, I'm seeing this scenario more. Thanks for your thoughts. So Chaya, I get it. You know, if they're there, we want to kill them, right? It's difficult to say whether they're hiding in the biofilm or they are, they're just at low levels. You know, I can't really wrap my head around the fact either that there's a degree that the lab considers normal, like they're presenting, but they're not considered pathogenic. My approach is, you know, to deal with it if you see other things presenting, as you said. You know, and it's also difficult to say, like your point of like, well, wouldn't they just multiply if, you know, under stress or whatever? But, you know, it's difficult to say that that would happen if we go ahead and support function and eliminate inflammatory foods and beef up beneficial flora and address any other issues that we see on the GI map. You know, it really depends on the client's presentation. You know, are they symptomatic? So we recommend going with the lab range for the protozoa. However, while you're seeing other things, you can use agents that will knock out both, you know, like the biocidin Olivarix GI detox triad. The other triad that we have would work just as well. The GI microbex, that's good for bacteria too, the AP Mag and the Interface Plus. I'm just finding that with my clients, because the biofilm disruptors built into the biocidin, it's a much easier, and you don't have to take so many pills. It's a much easier protocol to get compliance with. So the MAP is much more sensitive for all pathogens, with the exception of the fungal markers. Even this really cool test doesn't do a fabulous job of picking up yeast. I see it a lot, but I've also heard that it still misses fungal overgrowth a lot as well. So if that's the case, the biocidin Olivarix GI detox would take care of any yeast that wasn't really identified as well. So that's kind of our current favorite for dealing with any kind of pathogen.
A couple of people are asking about the Olivarix, the new healing solutions, which the class that's starting today, it's going to be in there. So give us a few days because we just finished updating it, but probably by the end of the week, you'll see the latest version of the healing solutions when you log into the classroom. And you'll see Olivarix on there. It's made by the same people who make the biocidin. And basically, I have a bottle here. It's high-dose olive leaf and then a variety of other herbs. So you've got garlic and golden seal, milk thistle, barberry, ginseng, bladderwrack, dandelion, noni, white willow. It's really great with all of these sorts of things. It's great with pathogens. It's great with yeast. It's great with viruses, actually. Olive leaf is extremely powerful with viruses. So just another really nice piece of this whole puzzle, and that's why it pairs so nicely with biocidin.
And we connected with the people that produce biocidin, and I'm working really hard to get them to come to a mind share and really talk about these three products. And give us more information on it. So I'm excited about that.
Okay, Gina asks, I have a new client who was diagnosed with diverticulitis 8 months ago. She recently found her birth mother and noted that most female members of her family have diverticulitis and arthritis. She's agreed to complete an MRT and GI MAP. Currently, she has pain in the left lower abdominal region. She'd like to avoid having a bowel resection. Besides the protocol I'd create based on her testing results, are there any other specific areas I should focus on with her? Diverticulitis, for anybody who doesn't know, is just an inflammatory condition within the little pouches that line the walls of the intestines, usually the large intestine, but it can be in the small intestine too. She absolutely needs to be under the care of an MD, which it sounds like she already is, because the worst case scenario here is that when these pouches get extremely inflamed and infected, you can develop a bowel obstruction or even a bowel rupture. So this is definitely a good case for you and a medical doctor to be co-managing this person and helping her along. But at its root, it's an inflammatory condition. So you can be a big help to her by keeping her digestion moving as smoothly as possible. Optimize her digestion north to south, keep her bowels moving smoothly. It's very possible with a history of diverticulitis that there can be some fibrosis or scarring that occurs in the intestines that can actually interfere with the passage of stool. So you want to be doing everything you can to make sure she's eliminating effortlessly. And of course, you want to eliminate any inflammation in the gut and the diet and be working to heal those through the appropriate testing. This is another person where immune support is probably a great idea because she's in a chronically inflamed state. And the product Mega Mucosa, for example, could be a great idea because you would be both working on any intestinal permeability and gut healing that needed to be done and improving her gut immune response. So you have a lot of tools that really can be a big help to her, even with what can be a complex situation. Gina has another client who has a redundant colon, which means she has an extra loop in her colon and has constipation issues. I figured she'd have longer transit time due to the longer colon. She's currently on Linzess, which is a medication, and saw improvement with bowel movements for a few months and then started experiencing constipation again. Her doctor last week increased the dosage, which caused her to run to the bathroom, which is very challenging for an elementary school teacher. The client needs to revamp her diet, but doesn't have the money to spend on testing right now. I'll guide her with some healing solution options for constipation, but would love some information on what to do for a redundant colon. This is one of those situations, Gina, it's really hard to know exactly what all you need to do to help her because you don't have any testing, right? So obviously, again, you want to optimize her digestion north to south, make sure that she's digesting fats to help with that constipation, make sure she has optimal acidity and that everything's just moving as smoothly as it can possibly be. Revamping her diet is great, but what if the healthy foods that you recommend are ones that she's reacting to? So we just don't really know, you know, because that drug worked for a while and then stopped working. We know there's still root cause issues here that need to be identified and addressed. Her problem is not a shortage of drug, right? There's something else that's going on, and it's just so hard to make any great headway here without testing. So one of the biggest things that you can do for her is really explaining that to her in the most loving, heartfelt way that you can, that, you know, you want to help her, but you need the information to know what you need to do.
Yeah. Okay, so Rachel has a question. How accurate do you find the GI map for H. pylori testing? I've had a few results come back that show no H. pylori and no virulence factors, but she's a chiropractor, so she can say patient, has been on PPIs for 7 years and has associated markers like Morganella and has symptoms of H. pylori. A GI map rep told me that I might have to send a sample that is collected over 2 days to catch the H. pylori, which is sad, as one of my favorite things about the test is that it's a one-day collection. Thoughts? So PCR testing is considered one of the most reliable ways to detect H. pylori, and it's notoriously difficult to detect. There are many different methods. There's breath testing, there's saliva testing, there's fecal testing, there's blood testing. You can be positive for one but negative on another one. So it's really, really problematic. Since using the GI map, I've seen a huge increase in the number of positive cases, even including, you know, when we were first teaching this class, we were using diagnostics panel, which had a salivary H. pylori marker. I've seen more H. pylori cases with the GI map than ever before in my practice. Still, there are no perfect tests, especially when it comes to this bacteria. I've also had multiple clients on a PPI for years who didn't have H. pylori. So I don't think that that is an assumption that we should be making, that if they've been on a PPI, they automatically have to have H. pylori. And I'm not sure what you're saying about this association between Morganella and H. pylori. I've never seen that anywhere. Morganella can be associated with SIBO, but I'm not aware of any relationship with H. pylori. Anyone who's been on a PPI will have signs and symptoms similar to that of H. pylori, but it can be just simple hyperchlorhydria with gastric irritation from delayed stomach emptying. I've also recently had a few cases with the GI map where the initial test didn't show H. pylori, but it was present on retest. Now, whether that's a case of lab error on the first one, or the H. pylori was hiding on the first one, I don't know. My recommendation is just to address it when you see it. And I would suggest that you have your client, you know, wean off the PPI, do that upper gastric healing, start HCL, address the bacteria, the Morganella, and see what presents on the retest. I mean, almost always I've been successful using that method.
Okay, Dr. Rachel also asks, why do you use the 2-hour BioHealth SIBO test? Genova offers a 3-hour, 8-vial lactulose breath test that costs around $180. I've heard that a 2-hour test will not reach the end of the ileum, especially if a patient has slow transit time. Also, if a patient has a lactulose sensitivity and we use glucose only, is the accuracy only for the first part of the duodenum, since glucose is all absorbed in the first 1/3 of the small intestine? Would we miss the SIBO hanging out in the lower parts? So Dr. Rachel, you know, we all realize there's no perfect test to detect SIBO. The small intestine is just a really hard place to get to and to test accurately. And this is why we are now preferring to use the BioHealth combination test. And this is both a lactulose test and a glucose test that you do on 2 consecutive days. So you're getting the best of both worlds by being able to use both of those sugar solutions. We know that different bacteria are going to feed off of different types of sugar, and you could be negative on a glucose test but positive on a lactulose test, and vice versa. As for the timing, you know, the labs tell us that the earlier we have the rise in the gases, the higher up in the small intestine the overgrowth is likely to be. And also that if we don't see a rise in the gases until the last sample's collected, which is at 120 and 135 minutes, because that's the length of the test, that means the bacterial overgrowth is then thought to be in that distal ileum of the small intestine. BioHealth actually changed their tests early last year to be 120 and 135 minutes long. The two sugar solutions are slightly different. And collected at 15-minute intervals throughout that time period. So the Genova test is doing 8 vials across 3 hours. So that's much more spread out. And they made this change based on an early 2018 consensus statement that came out from the Gastroenterology Society that was looking at peer-reviewed literature. That really stated that 2 hours of testing is sufficient. They've extended that one test to 135 minutes just to take care of anybody who has slow transit times. But what they have said is that 3 hour testing really isn't necessary because the sugars are very rapidly absorbed. And in fact, for most people, 90 minutes is the mark when the solutions would be passing into the large intestine. But again, the 120 and 135 minute marks are to take into account any slow transit time. So that's why we like the combination test and why the test is only 2 hours long.
Perfect. Perfect. Okay, that was the end of the forum questions. So let's start with your questions that you've just submitted.
I have to grab my power cord, Anne, if you want to take the first question.
Okay, sure. Jolene asks, today the results came back from a GI map. Why would H. pylori come back within range, but with the virulence factors high? Do I treat for H. pylori? We don't treat, Jolene. We would address when this is the case. No, it's just telling you that there are potential virulence factors, but if the H. pylori itself did not come back elevated, and you know, you really wouldn't address it at all. She does have GI issues, but this is the only marker that came back out of range. So if the H. pylori is not a problem, we don't address it. Sometimes you will see the virulence factors light up as positive, even though there is no H. pylori. And it's just saying that she has the genetics for the potential for whatever the virulence factor is indicating, whether it's a duodenal ulcer or cancer or whatever, but she doesn't actually have the H. pylori. So you wouldn't necessarily do anything. Now, if she's got upper gastric, you say GI symptoms, but I'm not clear if that means like upper gastric or lower gastric. I would do what we do, heal up. Just as I described to Dr. Rachel, go ahead and address what you do find and then see what's there upon retest.
Okay. Going in order asks, can you talk about minerals and how you assess a client's status? I know you no longer do HTMA. I do know and use the zinc taste test at times. Do you recommend a client making and using Solae water? I feel like we were just talking about this the other day and I can't remember exactly why, but yeah, you know, it's really challenging to figure out exactly how to address mineral status. You know, there's blood testing that can be done, but there's some question about, is serum blood testing really accurate way to look at some of these minerals since they're frequently held in the red blood cells? You can test some RBC levels of some minerals, but that's generally very expensive. And so there aren't a lot of great ways that we find to specifically address mineral status. Anne, what are your thoughts on it?
You know, I think that, you know, I would go with the blood markers. I don't think that there's a really accurate way to look at mineral status. I mean, you could do something like Patricia Kane has a whole series of formulations. I can't remember what her company is called, but you can look up Patricia Kane and it'll come up. And they're exactly like the zinc taste test, but they're for all the various minerals. It's extraordinarily expensive. But they last a really long time. So that would be another way to do it. And other than that, I would go with the blood chemistries and symptomology. You know, if somebody's experiencing cramps or that kind of thing, addressing it specifically with challenging the supplements.
Have you ever had anyone do the Solae water?
I have not.
I have not either, Darlene. Sorry that we could not be more helpful there.
Amanda. She has a 26-year-old female client who had open heart surgery for a congenital defect. She's recovered well and is working with Amanda to get ready to get pregnant. They're working on gut and boosting immune system. And then they'll start looking at her hormones. Her question is, she gets sick a lot, especially strep throat. Her doctor thinks it's essential that she always takes antibiotic every time she gets sick because they are concerned that if the bacteria or virus goes to her heart, it could be dangerous. I told her of the challenges to her immune system with continuing to take antibiotics, and it is likely reason why she's often getting sick. She wanted to try a natural approach, and I've started her on the biocidin protocol along with high doses of MediHerb throat spray. She feels like she's getting sick again, though many of her symptoms sound like a detox reaction. I feel like I'm walking a fine line here. She doesn't want to be risking anything unnecessarily and causing any potential dangers to her heart, but at some point, Amanda feels that she has to stop the antibiotics every time she gets sick and focus on immunity. I would be really cautious with that, Amanda, just because I think you are walking a really fine line, kind of countering what our doctor is saying. However, she gets to decide, right, whether she wants to take the antibiotics or not. So I wouldn't make that recommendation. I would kind of come at it from, let me just tell you about another way of looking at this, and then, you know, just let me know what works for you. I wouldn't be trying to, you know, persuade her in any direction. I would be focusing on immune support and really figuring out why her immune system, you know, in addition to the antibiotics, is so very challenged right now. You know, what's going on with her? Is it just the result of the surgery, or is there something underlying that, you know, really depressed immunity? And the first place I'd look would be the gut.
So Amanda says they did a GI map. There were lesions. She's presented it exactly like you say, and the woman is tired of always taking antibiotics.
Perfect. Yeah, I think, you know, just be careful and make those notations, and, you know, I think you'll be fine.
Let's see. Michelle says, I have a client whose GI map came back with H. pylori within range, but had 4 positive virulence factors. Does the large number of virulence factors have any special significance? You know, the interpretation guide that we've provided in the healings in the level one is so valuable because I can never remember what all these virulence factors are and what they individually mean. And so when I see them, I go and look them up, and certainly encourage you to do that too, so that you're sure that you understand what each of them means. But it doesn't have any special significance that she has multiple virulence factors, other than it just means that the H. pylori that's present is a tiger. You know, it's got a lot of real power to wreak some havoc in her system. You didn't say anything about whether this person has any symptoms or not, but if there were any upper gastric symptomology at all, inability to handle HCL, gurgling, gnawing in the morning, in the stomach, anything, I would be all over doing an H. pylori protocol with that person. Anne, what do you think?
So the virulence factors are really genetic markers. You know, they're telling us if there's any kind of genetic propensity attached to the H. pylori presentation. And so, you know, it doesn't tell us that those genes are turned on. It's just genetic propensity. And so, and it's also, you know, telling us if the gene is turned on, what the potential risk would be if the H. pylori was elevated. So as Ellen said, I would do exactly the same thing. If this person is really symptomatic with upper gastric, you know, presentation, I'd probably, you know, go after it and just do the H. pylori protocol.
Okay, and then Ellen says, how would it look to combine the Olivirex in a protocol, given the name of my roadkill eating teen? Can you write out how these would be taken together? If you give it just a couple days, Ellen, you'll be able to go look at the healing solutions with our protocol models in there, and it will explain exactly what the dosing would be and how we would do those together.
And you look for the date at the bottom of the healing solutions. Tiffany is right now putting it together. It should be posted literally within a day or two. So watch for that, and it'll have like a March, early March date. Joey asked, does RWS recommend Metula tea for addressing H. pylori? none of us use it, Joey, because we've been so successful with the BioHPF and the Mastica. So, you know, it's not something that we've really looked into, and it's so darn expensive. You know, I have a hard time asking a client to pay that much money for a tea. So no, we haven't really gotten into that. Right. A lot of people on the Facebook group are mentioning it. You know, I would ask those practitioners. It's just not something that we've really gotten into. I would feel horrible if I asked a client to spend, you know, like $300 on a tea and then it didn't work. So I'm afraid to try it because I know the other protocol works.
You're welcome, Joey.
Okay, we have 5 more minutes. Any other questions? So Kate asks, if you have to repeat a GI map, I assume you stick with the MRT eliminations for the second test. not necessarily, Kate, because those sensitivities that come up really are only going to be relevant for 3 months for the yellows and 6 months for the reds. So if upon retest you're seeing that there are new pathogens or a pathogen is still there, I would, before you start the protocol or even like while you're restarting the second protocol, I would have the client specifically start introducing those MRT foods one by one to determine which ones they can tolerate and bring in rotationally or which ones they continue to need to avoid if they are reactive to them. So I don't think there's any reason to have them avoid them any longer.
Michelle asks if we have any thoughts on GI Resolve with its high dosage of L-glutamine. I haven't used it yet because I love GI Revive. Anne, have you given it a try?
I haven't. I've looked at that formulation, Michelle, and it looks really great. You know, it looks really great. I just, like Ellen, I'm kind of sold on GI Revive. Mary Jane asks, what news on what Chris Kresser said at the conference? Oh, good question, Mary Jane. So he was the last speaker yesterday, and I specifically made a point of going in there and listening, and his presentation was on behavior change, you know, how we can, you know, really help people make behavior change. And it was full of a lot of good statistics and that kind of thing. He did have time for questions, and absolutely no one brought anything up. And I didn't either. You know, what I kind of feel right now is that, and especially in light of like the first day speakers, which were, in my opinion, the absolute best, Tira Onai, Low Dog, what was the one, Ellen Gibson?
Her first name was Diane, and her last name was Jay.
Something like that. She was fantastic. And then even kind of this squirrely cardiologist, Gaia Wolfson.
Jack Wolfson. Sarah Ballantyne the next day.
Sarah Ballantyne. So, you know, like most of them were talking about looking at markers and, you know, testing and kind of making the assumption that we do that. So I felt really validated in that regard. And you know, we kind of brought it up in our talk. Margaret and I kind of hit it head on in our talk and just said, you know, basically that using TESTA is just additional data. And the more data that we have when we are making a determination in our guidelines using our tools, which are diet, supplements, and lifestyle, the more successful we're going to be. And so we're just kind of like leaving it there. NTA is fine with everything. And, you know, so it's just one of those things that, you know, kind of zoomed up everybody got really excited about it, and then it's kind of gone now. So that's kind of where we are.
Amanda makes a nice comment here regarding the Matula tea. She says that she recommends stronger products instead. A tincture of those same herbs, so alcohol-based, would be much stronger than a water extract. She's had a tea company for 15 years, and 60 tea bags should never cost anywhere close to $200. So that's
thanks for that, Amanda. Thank you.
Well, I just wanted to let everybody know what we have coming up, of course, later this month on the 20th. Anne is going to lead us into a deep dive on the liver, which should be great. And then, of course, in April, we have our Q&A again. And then Margaret's going to do a business session about the core principles of successful marketing.
Excellent. Thanks so much, everybody, for a really good call.
Yeah, great.
Appreciate you guys so much. All right.
Have a good night.
We'll see you soon.
Bye-bye.